Is it live or is it Memorex? Well, I don't know what's going on with that bumper music, but it was certainly breaking up there.
As the power of a V6 and the efficiency of a...
And the power of a V6 and the efficiency of... Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. today is the 6th of August, 2018. It's a Monday. Your mind is your primary weapon. You're tuned into Liberty Tree Radio. It's about 5 minutes after 8 a.m. Arizona time. We'll get back to our block of instruction about General Grievous on guerrilla war in Cyprus. Have some interesting border information. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. altabib762@hotmail.com. As always, dedicate this broadcast to Lily, Grace, Antoinette. And thanks for taking the time to tune in today to Liberty Tree Radio. And thank you for helping support Liberty Tree Radio. Also, just as a heads up, also do a broadcast over on the Micro Effect starting the same time, but it goes for 2 hours on Thursday and Friday. And if you'd like to call in today, telephone is 712-432-0900. 712-432-0900. Voice comes on, ask you to enter the room number, 957-464, and then the pound sign. If you'd like to be part of the discussion today, you can star 6, we'll unmute your phone, and after you have your say, then star 6 will remute your phone. Thanks for taking the time to support Liberty Tree Radio. The usually around the middle of the year or so, let's try to start collecting funds to pay the next year's bill. And so if you can find it, please help support Liberty Tree Radio. I came across an article the other day, and there's two of them. One is has the news article, and then one is, it's got also a link to the indictment. And this is out of insightcrime.org, and it's dated 30 July 2018. U.S. charges point to rampant corruption at Venezuelan state oil company. U.S. authorities are charging a network of Venezuelan elites and international financial actors with laundering over $1 billion stolen from the state-owned oil company, illustrating once again how corruption has ransacked. That's weird. Okay, businessmen who have been given the moniker Boliburgues, B-O-L-I-B-U-R-G-U-E-S, along with several Venezuelan officials allegedly embezzled more than $1.2 billion from Venezuela's state-owned oil company, Petróleos de Venezuela, S.A., P-D-V-S-A. Between 2014 and 2015, and later attempted to launder the funds through U.S. and European banks, according to a July 23rd criminal complaint filed in the federal court in Florida. The PDVSA officials and business people involved allegedly exploited Venezuela's foreign currency exchange system to increase the value of the company's funds obtained from the oil. And that's the end of that. Now, usually when I make presentations on the news, when I first started out, I'm kind of a who, what, where, when, how, etc. And some listeners had contacted and said sometimes this stuff gets a little draggy, so I generally don't go too far, kind of give you the gist of it, where you can go check the information for yourself, and I'll leave it at that, because as usual, there's just so many crime things about beheadings and mass murders and everything going on in Mexico and Venezuela and El Salvador and et cetera, et cetera. I just kind of wonder that, you know, the once again, the news media just seems to be all over this, President Trump and the Russians and President Trump and collusion and investigations. And, well, this is from the Department of Justice, the United States of America versus Francisco Convit Guceriga, Guceriga. And let's see, I don't necessarily, United States District Court, Southern District of Florida, document 3 and entered on FLSD docket. Oh, here it is. Yeah, it's, okay, it's the 24th of July. Now, it's 33 pages long, and no, I'm not going to. But it starts off here. Did the matter originate from a matter pending in the northern region of the United States Attorney's Office prior to October 14, 2003? No. Did this matter originate from a matter pending in the central region of the United States Attorney's Office prior to September 1, 2007? No. And respectfully submitted it, Benjamin G. Greenberg, United States Attorney, by Francisco R. Matterall, Assistant United States Attorney, bar, phone number, etc., email at contact. Okay, good. Let's see. The complainant in this case, state that the following is true, the best of my knowledge, behalf on or about the dates of December 2014 to July of 2018 in the country of, in the county of Miami-Dade in the Southern District of Florida, the defendants violated Section Title 18 United States Code Section, a conspiracy to commit money laundering, Title 18 United States Code Section, interstate and foreign travel in aid of racketeering enterprise. The criminal campaign is based on these facts. See attached affidavit. Okay. George F. Fernandez, Special Agent with Homeland Security Investigations, have been first duly sworn, do hereby depose and state as follows. Introduction. I'm an investigative or law enforcement officer in the United States within the meaning of Section as Title 10. That is, I am an officer of the United States who, empowered by law to conduct investigations of and to make arrests for offenses enumerated in Title 18 United States Code. I have not necessarily included in the affidavit each and every fact known to me about the matter set forth herein, but only those facts and circumstances I believe are sufficient to establish probable cause for the court to sign a criminal complaint statements contained affidavit based on my investigation. All times, dates, and amounts stated herein are approximate quotations and summaries of record conversations based on transcriptions with side-by-side Spanish to English translators or actual Spanish language recordings. In reviewing transcripts, I relied on both translation and my knowledge of Spanish as well as the others. Affidavit is made support a criminal complaint charging the following defendants with conspiracy to commit money laundering violation of Title 18 United States Code Section 1956H, violations of the Travel Act and violation of Title 18 United States Code Section 1955. Okay. Let's see. Defendants and others involved. Francisco Convit, C-O-N-V-I-T, Guceriga, is a Venezuelan national. Convit, along with Conspirator 2, is often referred to as a Bolichico, or member of the Bole Burgess. Jose Vicente Amparan Coker, a.k.a. Chente, is a Venezuelan national and professional money laundering. Amparan is associated, along with Conspirator 5 and 6, with European Company 1 in Spanish, which is a money laundering front operation as real estate investment firm. Amparan also maintains relationship with European Financial Institution 1 in Malta, a private investment firm which he uses to launder money. Carmelo Urdanete Akit is a Venezuelan national and former legal counsel of the Venezuelan Minister of Oil and Mining. Abraham Eduardo Ortega is a Venezuelan national and former executive director of finance of Venezuela's state-owned oil service, Petroles de Venezuela S.A. Gustavo Adolfo Hernandez Freire is a Colombian national by birth and naturalized U.S. citizen as of May 3, 2013. Gustavo is a professional money launderer who uses his financial firms Global Security Advisors, GSA, and Global Strategic Investment in Miami, Florida to launder money with false mutual fund investments. Hugo André Ramalho Góis, G-O-I-S, is a Portuguese national professional money launderer associated with Amparan, A-M-P-A-R-I-A-N. Let's see. Matthias Krull is a German national and Panamanian resident. Krull was a high-level banker at a large Swiss bank specialized in Venezuelan clients. Krull is a professional banker of Venezuelan. Krull is the personal banker of Conspirator 7 and others. Krull manages banking activities for numerous Venezuelan officials and kleptocrats. Marcial Federico Gutierrez Acosta y Alarva is an Uruguayan national. Gutierrez is part of an ownership group of at least one U.S. bank that facilitates money laundering and is associated with Gustavo. Conspirator 1 through 9 are some of the additional uncharged members of the conspiracy along with others. Conspirators 1 through 9 include other former PDVSA officials, individuals associated with Convit, reported members of the Bolí Burgess, and professional third-party money laundering Venezuelan officials. 1 to 3 are foreign officials. Probable cause, 2016, a confidential source approached the HSI Miami office regarding 78 million in euros the CS received, which originated from a loan contract with PDVSA. The CS, the confidential source, was involved in a money laundering conspiracy and wanted to surrender the money and cooperate. HSI Miami thereafter began an undercover investigation, organized crime and drug enforcement task force, OCD ETF, Operation Money Flight. The CS agreed to wear a recording device, and operative Money Flight proceeded proactively with an initial focus on the defendant's efforts to launder a portion of the $78 million in euros, the PDVSA funds, in and through South Florida. 2 years and over 100 recordings later, Operation Money Flight revealed an international conspiracy to launder the PDVSA funds through Miami and several large-scale international third-party money laundering organizations. More specifically, the investigation revealed the use of Miami real estate and sophisticated false investment schemes to launder hundreds of millions of U.S. dollars. Let's see. Venezuela has a foreign currency exchange system under which the government will exchange a local currency, bolivars, at a fixed rate for U.S. dollars. The fixed exchange rate has been well below the true economic rate by a substantial factor for several years. For example, 2014, Venezuelan government fixed exchange rate was approximately 6 bolivars to 1 U.S. dollar. By contrast, the true economic exchange rate was approximately 60 bolivars to 1 U.S. dollar. The difference between the fixed rate and the true economic rate creates opportunity for fraud and abuse. For example, 2014, an individual could exchange 10 million U.S. dollars for 600 million bolivars at the true economic rate. Then if that individual had access to the government fixed rates, he could convert that same 600 million bolivars into 100 million U.S. dollars. Essentially, the two transactions, that person could buy 100 million U.S. dollars for only 10 million U.S. dollars, etc. I'm not going to go into, I've got quite a few of these, this deal. False investment money. Well, most of the defendants are sophisticated operators with respect to the international banking system and are aware of banks' generally due diligence in anti-money laundering practices, including know your customer requirements. Importantly, for the one party to wire funds to the third party, there must be some legitimate business justification provided for the bank, for instance, payment of the purchase of real estate or equipment. Moreover, a bank will ask for documents supporting the justification, which, depending on the transaction, can be difficult to manufacture. For instance, a bank may be able to verify whether a supposed real estate transaction took place. The verification poses a problem for money laundering transactions in which large sums of criminal proceeds must be moved around for the financial system from one person to another as bribes, kickbacks, transfers, or exorbitant expenditures, for instance. So like I say, this indictment's 33 pages long. Now I just blasted through 7 pages. So if, you know, I just kind of wonder what, you know, this isn't happening in some country far, far away on the other side of the earth. And, you know, this is happening right here in the United States. But, of course, the news media's not going to report on that. Of course it's not, because they're going to be too busy talking about President Trump and the Russians and his tweets and, oh, we got him now, and, oh, all we need to do is have this going on and that going on. And then you wonder why the people in Venezuela are starving to death because of, oh, well, it's because of those evil United States sanctions on them. They can't sell their oil. Well, it certainly appears to me that they're doing a pretty good job about selling their oil, and $1.2 billion to funnel off the top of it, and so they can sit over here in money laundering scheme and buying and selling euros and exchange rates and bolivars and make $100 million out of a $10 million investment and then come to Miami and buy real estate to hide their transactions. I would just kind of wonder why we're not hearing about this in the United States. But, of course, it's the old look over here, look over here, look over here story. This is what we're going to tell you that's all important, just like they did a couple of weeks ago with all these kids trapped in that cave over in Thailand. Look over here, look over here, look over here. But we're not going to talk about the mass murder and mayhem going on in Mexico and how many, what was that, 120-some politicians that were running for office on the election on the 1st of July that were killed, and we're not going to talk about that. Oh, one of the report. Yes.
Yeah, Jim from Illinois.
Good morning. Okay. Good morning.
Anyway, I would conjecture that it goes to continuity of government, why things aren't being reported, and in part, you know, I'm going off the cuff right now. I haven't given this a great deal of thought, but normally we think of continuity of government as that to preserve that of the administrative state. And we, as individual men, forget our responsibility as being well-regulated a militia being necessary to a free state, you know. And I'm not forgetting the other part of that second article, but I've got to go forward from here right at the moment. And so the continuity of government is the responsibility of the people. It is our government. We own it. We instituted it. Therefore, what powers we delegated to this government, we can't delegate any powers that we don't have ourselves as given by the Creator. And when you have an administrative state or the actors within that administrative state who then carve out additional powers that an individual man does not have by or has not been given by the Creator, then you're talking about a rogue and criminal agency or agents within our government. Now, you know, the news media, I conjecture aren't reporting on this criminal activity, because what we see is the new crime syndicates or subcategories or subclasses of the crime syndicates being established, being worked out south of the border, and then slowly infiltrating into our borders, all right?
See? And,
go ahead.
No, I agreed with you. Yes, see, CC, senor.
Oh, see. Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay. Anyway, once you know, and you wouldn't want to establish that, or I mean, press that issue in the media, lest you alert the population of this host nations, the several states united. You get it established, and then it goes from there. And that would go in line with, I've been doing a little bit of study as to the guerrilla warfare as it was occurring in the Philippines during the Japanese invasion in World War II. So you know, this is a matter of it's rather abstract and confusing to me at times, but it is the actors within our government fighting, acting as if we're insurgents, and establishing insurgent forces within our government to to establish a continuity of government or control of the governmental mechanism for future. So they lay this down. You know, these things don't happen overnight. It would take. They may work on it for a half century or more. And the thing is men, they have a relatively short lifespan in the breadth and depth of time from creation forward. But corporations, they live on in perpetuity, and that's something we must think about. One thing I'll stop. I'll yield at that. And one thing I want to ask: do you have a publication titled "Guerrilla Warfare Tactics in Urban Environments"? If not, I can send it. It's put together by Patrick D. Mark, Major USA, 1990. And then it has Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, 2003. You want me to send you that?
Yes. I kind of think that I have that, but I don't have it. It's on a flash drive, giggy thing. So I know I have one. It's something about urban tactics and guerrilla war, but I'm not exactly sure. But yeah, if you could go ahead and send me that.
I'd email it, so it'd still be in a electronic form again. So
yes.
All right, I'll send that to you.
Okay, yeah, very good, because I can always just load that and add that onto my library. I've got, I don't know, hundreds of associated types of information all in and around. There has been, and you mentioned that from that Fort Leavenworth, that's the Army and General Staff College and that, and there has been some very enlightening information that has come out of that, especially in the last 5 years. But a lot of these principles, like you mentioned, whether it came from 1990s, a lot of them are still pertinent. It's nice to assemble a library you can see the evolution of the thought process of whether it's insurgency or counterinsurgency, on how, you know, back in the day they thought that they could just bomb these people into the Stone Age, and that usually is quite counterproductive, because all that does is drive the people into the arms of the insurgents. And the old adage now is you can't kill your way out of an insurgency, even though sometimes we certainly try.
There's another publication I ran across. It's titled Operations Against Guerrilla Forces. And it was unclassified 2nd December 1994. And it's from the U.S. Army Military something Institute. I can't make it out. It's a scanned copy of a hardback book, it appears. The Infantry School, Fort Benning, Georgia, September 1950. So I'll send you a PDF of that one also.
Interesting. Hey, 1 second right now. I see we're right there at the bottom of the hour. If the music comes in, just hang around, and we'll pick this up on the other side, if you will. S'il vous plaît.
Very well. Yeah.
boy, oh boy, it's no fun being an illegal alien. I didn't say that. I just played the song. Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Your mind's your primary weapon. Today is the 6th of August, 2018. It is Monday. Liberty Tree Radio. I got about 36 minutes after 8 a.m. The first 30 minutes of today's broadcast, we discussed an article of about insightcrime.org about an indictment down in the U.S. District Court in Florida of a bunch of Venezuelan businessmen that were laundering $1.6 billion U.S. dollars, buying and selling euros and bolivars and buying property and everything. And I just had the question of why is it that we can hear all about all these other issues, but when it happens here in the United States that... Now, I will admit, there's another broadcast on another network I was listening to last night, and the person appears to me has his head screwed on pretty straight. A couple of weeks ago, he had mentioned the deal about Venezuela, and last night he was talking about this indictment. So I've known about this since like the middle of last week, but it was just down in the stack, and I hadn't been able to get to it to cover that aspect. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. Alpha, Lima, Tango, Hotel, Alpha, Bravo, Echo, Bravo, 762@hotmail.com. As always, we send this one out to Lily, Grace, Antoinette. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today, and thank you for helping support Liberty Tree Radio. And as a reminder, I'll be back on the air on the Micro Effect on Thursday and Friday from 8 to 10 Arizona time. Starts the same time as this broadcast does, but it goes for 2 hours each day. And let's see what else. If you'd like to call in like Jim did, it's 712-432-0900, 957-464, and the pound sign will get you into the room, and star 6 will unmute your phone. Jim, are you still there?
Yeah, I am.
Okay.
The other publication I ran across that I'll email to you, Mike, is A Leader's Handbook to Unconventional Warfare. It's put together, I believe, by Lieutenant Colonel Mark Grodovich, G-R-D-O-V-I-C, and that's how that's spelled. And this is U.S. Army John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and School. And they have the little emblem there. It says Veritas et Libertas. I guess that means truth is liberty. I don't know. That could be it. Somebody correct me if I am wrong. And so I'll send that one to you also.
I'd appreciate that.
And there is one fella out of the Philippines. I read about him briefly in the guerrilla war, the stay behind guys who would not surrender to the Japanese and participate in the Bataan Death March, and who organized the guerrilla insurgency. I believe. If my terms are screwed up, you know, correct me, Mike. I am still teachable, and so that's one thing a good special forces man's got to be, is teachable. Anyway, his name is Volker, V-O-L-K-E-R, I believe. Does that sound familiar?
Well, I remember there was a Paul Volker, but was he in the military? Yeah.
Well, I'm not, you know, when I first read the name or read about it, I go, I wonder if this guy is related to the Volcker who was part of the, you know, Federal Reserve. I don't know. But, you know, this guy was in the Philippines. He was a stay-behind guy who did not surrender to the Japanese and continued to fight on in a guerrilla movement. And I think his name was Volker, but, you know, he was very instrumental in laying out the initial, some of the initial stuff that Banks and one other guy latched on to develop the special warfare schools and that with the Special Forces of Green Beret. And with that, I think I pretty much will yield, and I will say this. Listen, people, if we're to press liberty and truth, we need to be pressing the fiat Federal Reserve note in the palm of Liberty Tree Radio so we can keep this platform up. So Mike can share his knowledge with us. And your mind is your primary weapon. Thank you, Mike.
Hey, God bless you, man. Thanks for taking time to call.
God bless.
Interesting. Boy, we covered a lot of things, talked about the collusion with the administrative state and the bankers when they're talking about this money laundering, and then we switched to the Philippines. That's an interesting study of what had happened there with the people, and what was the guy that was in charge of the Hucks. They had originally started off, it was like something the Philippine people, the anti-Japanese occupation, it was about a mile long in their title. And then after the Japanese were defeated, then the Hucks became the Hucks that were up against Ramon Magsaysay and Colonel at the time, later to retire as Major General Lansdale. And so you had these people that are already well-established guerrilla fighters during World War II. They had moved beyond the political subversive aspect. They had already moved up to the armed struggle guerrilla aspect of that and were fairly effective in battling the Japanese occupation. And then how was it that I always find these three studies very similar and quite fascinating, because during that same time frame in the same general area and very similar type of terrain, you had the insurgency in Malaya, you had the insurgency in the Philippines, and to use the term lightly or in quotations, the insurgency in French Indochina, now as General Thompson has pointed out by government statistics, the Viet Minh and the Viet Cong in French Indochina were never really what we would consider an insurgency because they never really exceeded more than 1% of the population, so it couldn't be classified as a people's uprising. But oftentimes it's referred to as an insurgency. I guess if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck and swims like a duck. But anyway, I just find how those three similar countries, coastal, mountain, jungle, post-World War II, insurgencies that already developed fighting the Japanese, and then how some of them could be turned around and the insurgents could be defeated, and how some that didn't turn out that way. And it's read quite a bit on all of those areas of, but yes, the Philippines is quite another one. I have a book, it's a hardbound book, I think it's called Coast Watchers. Now, I haven't read it, but I'm pretty sure it has to do with the U.S. military had gone to the hills to run clandestine radio stations, binoculars, LPOP, monitoring Japanese activities and ships and things like that moving off the coast of the Philippines and reporting that information back to the United States about what's going on. The old Stay Behind Forces is an interesting study in itself as to where it's more than for today's broadcast, but and I'm not going to go into it, but it's definitely something. There's quite a bit of information in those deals of the tactics, techniques, and procedures of about not only the insurgents, guerrillas, terrorists, political subversives on one hand, the government forces on the other hand, and what one does and countermove and countermove and the mistakes that were made and assumptions. And like discussing there with Jim, it was quite interesting because of the publications that he's come across, that even though something had come up in 1990, 1994, or even before that from back in the 1950s, it's quite interesting to add that to a library as a reference material, because oftentimes they'll start off with one version of human factors in undergrounds and insurgent movements from back in the 1950s, 1960s or so, and then a new one will be published in January of 2015 or so as a companion piece to the previous one, as to where they're both quite interesting as to where how one springboards off the next, or the questions of how to address this insurgent aspect of that, the big debate, especially in Iraq and Afghanistan over the years, but it's pretty much stabilized by now. But it was it going to be a enemy or a population-centric counterinsurgency? And one of the first things they had to do for the longest time in Iraq was to even agree that there was an insurgency going on. Kind of maybe what had happened with stuff going over with General Grievous and his guerrilla war against the British in Cyprus. Because by the end of June 1955, the second phase of the campaign had ended, and the EOKA fighters were informed in a bulletin that the material results had not been up to the expectations of the leader. There had been a few casualties, and the damage caused by the sabotage had been relatively insignificant from the economic point of view. And presumably, it was this to which Grievous referred when he spoke of the material results. Now, in political terms, the EOKA campaign had already achieved a considerable measure of success. Remember, the primary purpose of the organization was being realized, and the issue of self-determination for Cyprus had been called dramatically to the attention of the world, and the British public opinion in particular had been aroused. And with the anticipated results, the policy of the government that had said it would never consider Cypriot independence, Cyprus supposedly being indispensable to the British military security in the Mediterranean, was being questioned. And there were already second thoughts about the word never. Now, 2 years earlier, the British had refused to discuss Cyprus with the Greek government. Now the Prime Minister, Sir Anthony Eden, sent invitations to both Athens and Ankara to attend a tripartite conference in London, and Archbishop Makarios, seeking a larger forum and a better solution than could be expected from the meeting, flew to Athens to press the Greek government to appeal to the United Nations. Before leaving, he sent Grievous his congratulations, adding, quote, EOKA has contributed infinitely more to the Cyprus struggle than 75 years of paper war. The name of Dagenis is an enigma to the British, and it is a legend as well. Already, it has passed into the pages of the liberation movement's history, end quote. Grievous was preparing a general attack timed to coincide with the meeting of the United Nations General Assembly in the fall. As an initial step, he proposed to put the native police force out of action as a reliable law enforcement agency so as to compel the British to extend their military forces, which were being used mainly to guard government buildings or held in the barracks for riot duty and similar emergencies. Now, in an order dated 28 June, he informed EOKA group leaders, quote, the aim of our next offensive will be to terrorize the police and to paralyze the administration, both in the towns and the countryside. If this aim is achieved, the result will be threefold. Disillusionment will spread through the police force so rapidly that most of them, if they do not actually help us, we'll turn a blind eye to our activities. Active intervention of the Army and security, which will stretch the troops and tire them out, the falling morale of the Army will also influence its leaders. And in the face of our strength and persistence and the trouble they cause, it is very probable that the United Nations, through member countries who take an interest in Cyprus affairs, will seek to bring about a solution. The results we want will be obtained by, 1, murderous attacks against policemen who are out of sympathy with our aims or who tried to hunt us down. 2, ambushes against police patrols in towns or raids on country police stations. And 3, obstructing free movement of the police across the island by laying ambushes against individuals or groups. End quote. Now, the police were given notice of what to expect in a leaflet posted on the walls in the villages and scattered through the city streets by school children. And this is the warning. To the police, I have warned you, and I shall carry out my warnings to the letter. Darker days await the tyrants of Cyprus. Heavier punishment, the traitors. Do not try to block our path, or you will stain it with your blood. I have given orders that anyone who tries to stop the Cypriot patriots will be executed. Anyone who tries to arrest or to search a Cypriot patriot will be shot. You have nothing to fear so long as you do not get in our way. EOKA, the leader, Degenis. Now, having given the warning, the EOKA proceeded with a series of raids on the police stations that served a twofold purpose. The attacks frightened the police and also gave the organization the means of getting badly needed arms, since few were arriving from Greece, where the first weapons and supplies had been obtained. Now, the campaign in the town lagged, a fact Grievous explains almost apologetically, was due to the total inexperience of the execution groups. Results were nevertheless obtained. Several policemen were killed and others wounded in Nicosia and Famagusta. Scores resigned, and those who remained, says Grievous, scarcely dared show their faces outside of their station. The effect of the raids was to throw the administration entirely on the defensive. Armed sentries walked around and armed the police stations at night. And when the police had to close the station temporarily, they took all of their weapons with them. The British knew next to nothing about EOKA, who its members were, where they might be found. And those who might have been able to tell them, the Greek Cypriot members of the police force, were soon silenced. On August 28th, a constable of the special branch, who had been marked for death because of his too zealous application to duty, was posted at a political meeting in Nedra Street in Nicosia. He was shot down before a crowd of hundreds by a young government clerk, Michael Karolous, a member of the three-man EOKA execution squad. The killing in broad daylight before hundreds of people in the heart of the capital was a fatal blow to the police morale. The killer, Karolous, was later caught and sentenced to death, but his work had been done. The slaying as a special branch man, says Grievous, shattered opposition to the EOKA amongst the Greek police. And increasingly, Turks were recruited to replace Greeks on the police force, intensifying the hostility between the two ethnic communities. Of the Greeks who remained on the British payroll, many became spies for the EOKA, accurately informing the organization of British intentions from day to day. Those who were not so employed closed their eyes to the EOKA activities, as Grievous had predicted, and ceased to be effective service to the British or a hindrance to the liberation movement. The British propaganda was bitter in its denunciation of the methods used by the EOKA, but Grievous was not concerned, and he later wrote, quote, "All war is cruel, and the only way to win against superior forces is ruse and trickery. You can no more afford to make a difference between striking in front and striking from behind than you can between employing rifles and howitzers. The British may criticize me as much as they like for making war in Cyprus, but I was not obliged to ask their permission to do so, nor can they now deny that I made it in the most successful way. End quote. Now, terrorism was supported by intensive political agitation that brought out huge crowds in the principal towns. And during one demonstration in Nicosia in September, army trucks were overturned and set afire, and the British Institute was burnt to the ground. The headlights generated by the activity failed to win Greek a hearing on the Cyprus question in the United Nations. And the Greek appeal was rejected on September 23rd, but the EOKA campaign had shaken British, and 2 days after the UN rejection, it was announced in London that a new governor would replace Sir Albert Armitage immediately. The replacement was the much-decorated Field Marshal Sir John Harding, an outstanding British general of World War II who had just relinquished the post of chief of the Imperial General Staff. He was, in fact, right grievous, the leading British soldier of the day, and no higher complaint could have been paid us than to send against our tiny force a man with so great a reputation and so brilliant a career. Harding, as it developed, was to have no better success against the EOKA than had his predecessor. And the appointment of the military man to replace the civilian governor made it clear that Downing Street intended to stamp out the EOKA by main force rather than to continue a police action. And the trouble, as is usually the case when opposing guerrillas, and even more so when fighting terrorists, was that there was nothing substantial against which to apply the force, as Grievous explained later. Now, I see we're right up top of the hour today, and without getting into the rest of this for today, because it's still a pretty extensive study, with no way we could wrap it up in 2 or 3 minutes here, but that's kind of what it is. So as we can see how people have a clear path that they chart and they stick with it, and when these principles are stuck to, and the demands, kind of reminds me of our lesson last week about let my people go. No, I'm going to harden my heart. I'm not going to do it. Okay, fine, then this is what I'm going to do. How about now? Nope, I'm going to harden my heart. Let my people go. No, can't make me. And then it keeps escalating and keeps ramping up and ramping up and ramping up, and pretty soon the government falls. Yeah, go ask the Pharaoh. They drowned in the Red Sea. You know the story. Well, that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Let's see, where did we go today? We were continuing our study about General Grievous on guerrilla war in Cyprus. I had one interesting news item about money laundering out of Venezuela. My email address is altabeep762@hotmail.com, and that's Alpha Lima Tango Hotel Alpha Bravo, Echo, Bravo, 762@hotmail.com. And as always, we send this one out to Lily, Grace, Antoinette. I'll see you over on the Micro Effect on Thursday. I hear some music coming in. I guess that means that's top of the hour. To remind you that your mind is your primary weapon. Thank you.
should be in a new Hollywood. Just a second there, I thought I saw something. Rocking, dancing, listening to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcuts, no twist and drag. Only a fool in here, he's got anything. I was a witch, but I was the truth. Don't get up, gentlemen, come on in, touch it. People are crazy, it's time to sing. I'm locked in tight, my brain used to care, but I'm searching. That eager.